Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. Movement and no movement on Charlotte's transit plan as Charlotte City Council ponders a pending vote on buying Norfolk Southern's tracks for the Red Line, and as the Matthews Town Council says no after the plan is changed to substitute buses for the Silver Line train. North Carolina's status as a battleground state strengthens as Kamala Harris returns to unveil her economic plan and Donald Trump comes to Asheville. A change in plans, courts decide both Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Cornell West can be on the North Carolina November ballot. As CMS prepares to go back to school this fall, they are already looking to next fall and changes to magnet schools and pupil assignments. The River District begins construction, an update on bringing Epicenter back to life, and COVID is on the rise here again. And here to talk about those stories and more is Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter, and Doss Helms, WFAE's education reporter. Mary Ramsey is back this week. She's local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Good morning, everybody. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, two big transportation plan stories this week. So let's begin with the positive one. Charlotte is preparing to vote on whether to purchase the O-Line tracks from Norfolk Southern for the Red Line commuter train to the northern towns in Mecklenburg. Ed McKinney, who is the city's point person for the transportation plan, says this has been a long time coming.
The point here, and again, take the big picture and step back, we've been under a 20-year, more than 20 years, of trying to get access to the O-Line. It's been a commitment of the plan of the MTC of the city, for sure, to have access. This is an unprecedented opportunity at this point.
Everything today is unprecedented, but Steve, this has been going on for two decades, so let's talk about how we got here all of a sudden, because for the longest time, there was no way we were going to get these tracks. Why has this suddenly become a possibility?
Well, I think it was the city said around 2021. Well, just to back up, Mike, Norfolk Southern owns the freight rail tracks. They have for years and years said they would not share them with the city. I think that the company overall had a policy about not sharing tracks. But a couple of years ago, they signaled a willingness with the city to negotiate. They started seriously talking last summer. And they now have a deal. We don't know how much the city is going to pay for the tracks. But like you said, September, there will be a vote to purchase them. The city will do that. The city council will vote yes. And that will be a big step in making the Red Line commuter train a possibility.
So would any agreement to purchase these tracks be contingent upon our getting permission to put a 1 cent sales tax on the ballot to support the transit plan? Because without that 1 cent sales tax, those tracks will be empty.
I think that's a great question. And Mary and Alex, you guys can, you know, jump in. I think it's just a straight up purchase. I mean, there is not an option on this. I think that the city will own the tracks.
Mary, any insight to share
on the tracks, I believe.
In that area? Okay.
That sounds like the message I heard this week too. And again, Alex, you were there, so feel free to jump in.
The only thing I would add is I think that the sales tax seems kind of contingent on the Red Line purchase, because the northern towns have made it very clear they're not going to support that. And we're already having our troubles with Matthews, but I'm sure we'll get into that. So
we're going to get into that right now, because the whole reason, we really fought to get this Red Line going is that the northern towns, Cornelius, Huntersville, Davidson, said they would not vote for an additional sales tax for transit if they didn't get the train, because they didn't get the train last time, and therefore they got nothing for saying yes the last time. To get the Red Line, however, under this new revised plan that the city revised because the legislature has to sign off on the referendum, and they said no to our transit plan, they didn't like it, they had to cut the Silver Line going to Matthews. And now those people are upset, naturally, and their town council just voted no on the revamped transit plan and said no to the 1 cent sales tax to support it. would council really, city council, Charlotte City Council, really embark on buying the Redland tracks if it looks like they're not going to get a yes vote from Matthews on the transportation plan? Would they really do that?
They will, yeah.
I think they might, just because, I mean, like Ed McKinney said, it's unprecedented, and it's a, it seems like Norfolk, I mean, they've been waiting for this for so long. So I think that they're very eager to hop on this opportunity. And also the Red Line's like very far into designs, and they've spent a lot of money on it. I mean, they spent money on the Silver Line as well. So, but.
And it's not really a question of whether Matthews will say yes. They've said no. They voted this week to say, we are not opposed to this. They called it, you know, had very negative things to say about the plan. They proposed either upping the sales tax to 1.4 cents to allow for more rail projects to be funded. And that's something that did come up at the Charlotte City Council transportation meeting. But I mean, it seems to be full steam ahead on the Charlotte side with Matthews.
Yeah, killing the Silver Line made Matthews officials furious. And Matthews Commissioner Ken McCool added this question to the mix.
How many public meetings have they hosted when they decided they wanted to change it to bus rapid transit? Zero. Not a single constituent has been heard.
Now, the legislature took issue with our plan, saying that it was too rail-centric and didn't concentrate enough on roads and therefore was dead on arrival in Raleigh if we didn't make changes. So we've made changes, and those changes are what resulted in Matthews saying no to the sales tax because they lost their train. Did legislators ever poll local constituents to see how they felt about all this, or is this just a power play in Raleigh?
I think this was just a philosophical decision in Raleigh, or philosophical decision made by local leaders in Mecklenburg County to do what they think, what Raleigh wants. You know, Phil Berger and Tim Moore have said in the past that the plan spends too much money on rail transit. So they've devised a plan to spend less to get it through in Raleigh, which, you know, you have to start somewhere. I think one of the key issues with the Silver Line decision is the Silver Line is the most important, most expensive of all the rail projects. They have less money. Something has to give. And so the city essentially just cut it. There are other options, though. You know, Mary talked about a higher sales tax being one. The other option, though, is to build half of the Silver Line, you know, to start in Uptown and take it as far as you can down Independence, maybe to Idlewild, somewhere around there. And then to pay for that, cut things like the Silver Line at the airport, cut the extension to Ballantyne, cut the streetcar. Those are some actual things they could do, but the city has not been talking about that at all. They've taken it as an all or nothing thing, and they're saying we had no choice. And that, you know, Ken McCool, the Matthews commissioner, was kind of getting at that. Look, this has all been made behind closed doors. It's not fair.
Yeah. So when the legislature said we needed to concentrate more on roads, did they mean buses as well? Because this would be bus rapid transit. I'm not sure that what people understand what that really is. And the question is, it has a bad rep. Is it really a bad thing, bus rapid transit?
I think a lot of people actually like bus rapid transit because it's really flexible, saves money. It's kind of like, I think people get a little frustrated with the streetcar because it's kind of in the way of traffic and you can't move around it. If you have a parked car, you can't get around that. So bus rapid transit can be a lot more flexible and it's fast.
I'll jump in, Mike, one more thing just about the bus rapid transit. In theory, it can be a good thing. You can have the buses can have their own special lanes. There can be stations, et cetera. It can go just as fast as a train. The problem is CATS hasn't done a study on BRT along Independence for nearly 20 years. The North Carolina Department of Transportation says, look, we've already redesigned Independence Boulevard. You can't put it there. So there's no plan. There's absolutely no plan. There may be a little bit of money, but I don't see really how this is going to be true BRT.
And Matt, BRT is bus rapid transit. And Matthews commissioners have said they hope their actions on voting no on this will derail this, quote, underfunded and reprehensible plan. They claim that they have been consistently lied to because they've been told that what they would be getting ultimately would be equitable and equal to everyone else. But they say they've been lied to because they're not going to get that. Have they been lied to, or is this just a necessity because of what Raleigh has mandated?
I think it depends on who you ask. I mean, Steve had a very interesting exchange with Marcus Jones at that city council meeting this week, trying to, you know, get a straight answer on whether the city of Charlotte did or did not tell Matthews during these negotiations that they weren't going to get the Silver Line, whether things are still up in the air, under analysis, things like that. So I think it really depends at this point on who you ask.
And Steve, you mentioned that there is no plan for bus rapid transit. There's no place to put it. There's no defined plan for that. And Matthews Mayor John Higdon is skeptical that the plan would actually result in bus rapid transit being implemented.
I would bet my house, and you can come get it if I'm wrong, that if BRT is built in Mecklenburg County, it won't be true BRT, and we won't have 100% dedicated lines.
And even members of Charlotte City Council empathize with that opinion, Councilwoman Renee Johnson.
Not only do I respect Mayor Higdon and the Board of Commissioners, I applaud them. I applaud them for standing up for their constituents and standing up for to do what they've promised for a long time.
And she added she didn't want to be part of a council, this is a quote, didn't want to be part of a council that selects winners or losers or makes what feels like a short-sighted decision. Bus rapid transit usually operates on dedicated lanes. No plans for that? Any ideas about where they could put those dedicated lanes? Has anybody talked about that yet?
No one has offered up a plan. Like I said, Independence appears to be out. I mean, you could build it along, you know, kind of, you could kind of recreate the train line for the bus, but then that's really, really expensive. So, you know, and one other thing as this debate rolls on, the city's new talking point is, well, all of these decisions will be made by the future transit authority. So they are now, that's kind of going to be the party line moving forward. Like when there are hard questions, it's going to be, well, it's not my call. It's going to be the future decision makers. So don't ask me. And Mike, I'll just say one more thing, because I know we need to move on. $43 million is a key number in all this. That's how much money the city has already spent designing the Silver Line light rail. $43 million.
And to put the kibosh on it right now is like throwing good money after bad. There's another part of this new plan. You just mentioned it. It's unsettling to many people. And that is the plan, the new plan, calls for the creation of this new 27-member regional transit authority that would control policy, strategy, and spending by the transit system and would have members on the board selected by Raleigh. Where do regional leaders, including those on city council, stand on that? Anybody?
There would be, like you said, 27, three would come from Raleigh, two from the legislature, one from the governor. I think they're okay with it just because they want to get it done. You know, they would just, if that moves the plan forward, they'll deal.
Okay, a couple more questions about all this, and then we'll move on because the presidential campaigns are coming to North Carolina on a regular basis. Kamala Harris will be here this afternoon, in Raleigh at least, for her eighth time in recent memory. And Donald Trump was in Asheville earlier this week. Are we or are we not a swing state? We'll talk about that and more when we come back with Steve Harrison from WFAE and Ann Doss Helms, also from WFAE, Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, and Alex Sands from Axios Charlotte. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Alex, the Charlotte City Council, a couple more questions about this transit plan. The Charlotte City Council has questions themselves about the Silver Line, about the sales tax, and I'm sure the fact that Matthews has suggested increasing the sales tax to more than a penny might be on the table, and they might have questions about that, and they have questions about any extension of the streetcar, because that is something that might have to go by the wayside to meet the monetary restrictions of all this. Will all of these things be points of discussion in the coming weeks on council before they vote on buying the railroad tracks from Norfolk Southern?
I don't know if they're going to get to all that because they have this discussion coming up on the 26th. That's when the full council is going to talk about transit. And I just don't know if they're going to be able to get to all of those. And also, kind of what Steve was saying, they've been pointing to this regional transit authority, saying that when that exists, they would make the decisions. We're not making the decisions right now, even though the draft legislation very clearly prioritizes the red line. Decisions about things like the Gold Line extension or the Silver Line, they're not talking about that right now.
Mary.
Yeah, I think it's just worth noting, too, that in addition to questions about the actual substance of the draft legislation, we've also heard concerns from some council members about how it was developed and about a lack of transparency. Some council members coming out and saying, well, why weren't more of us elected officials involved in this negotiation? You know, that being said, there were similar comments made during the Panther Stadium deal, and we all saw how that vote went. So,
well, I was going to say, this is becoming a refrain by members of city council about being in the dark about major decisions that they have to vote up or down on coming from city staff. Am I imagining that, or is this an ongoing situation? And if so, why aren't they taking the bull by the horns and doing something about it? They're in charge.
I don't think you're imagining it. I think it sounds to me like very similar refrains to the Panther Stadium. Why weren't we brought in earlier? Why is this all happening so fast? Why is there such a tight deadline? So it remains to be seen what they're going to do about it, but it's definitely a lot of the same concerns bubbling back up. But again, Panther Stadium deal ended up coasting through final on the final vote. So it remains to be seen whether this will be an actual hurdle.
Remains to be seen what they will do. I think we can say there will be a handful of council members who will complain. And then the main answer will be nothing. They will vote for it and it will happen again in 6 months or a year. And song remains the same.
Okay. Alex, you say that Norfolk Southern has set a September 9th deadline for a decision on whether Charlotte will acquire their tracks. Why, after 20 years of saying no, are they suddenly setting a deadline for a yes?
Yeah, we don't know why they're setting a deadline we don't know clearly why they're changing their policy. I mean, we know that Norfolk Southern is going to owe more than $1 billion because of this derailment in Ohio. So maybe that has something to do with it. Why they would decide to start to be willing to sell the tracks of the city now. But no clear answer as to why we have this very tight September 9th deadline.
So if we, theoretically speaking, we will say yes to buying the tracks for the red line. We will own the tracks. Matthews will say no to the sales tax referendum. Does that put the kibosh on it? In other words, just because the town council says no does not mean that the citizens will vote no on the referendum. But if they do, are there enough people in Matthews, if they all got together and voted no, to torpedo this?
I would say no, just because Matthews is not that big. And you've got, you've brought the northern towns on board. City of Charlotte will decide the election, will decide the referendum. So not a difference maker.
And if you just brought up, Steve, the fact that the planning on the now canceled, possibly canceled Silver Line, we spent $43 million on that. The price tag for this new plan has risen. It now stands at $25 billion with a B. That's up from the 2021 estimate of $13.5 billion. Why so much?
Construction costs are increasing rapidly in all sectors, and I think in transit in particular. It just it's just kind of astronomical increases. And you know, and the plus side for the city, the economy is growing, so the sales tax revenue is growing as well. I'm just not sure that the sales tax is going to grow as fast as it needs to cover the cost, that the inflation that we're seeing to build things.
Okay. Speaking of inflation, a Democratic presidential nominee, Vice President Kamala Harris, returns to the state today. She'll be speaking in Raleigh to unveil her economic plan, and this puts Harris and Donald Trump on the same page, because when he was in Asheville earlier this week, that's what Trump said he wanted to talk about.
Now, this is a little bit different day, because this is in a row. This is, we're talking about a thing called the economy.
And he characterized the plan that Harris will unveil here today this way.
When Kamala lays out her fake economic plan this week, probably will be a copy of my plan, because basically that's what she does.
He's referring, of course, to her adoption of his proposal to have no tax on tips, something he did, in fact, propose first. Do we have any idea what she may be talking about unveiling today in Raleigh?
There are reports that she is going to be talking about new efforts to control price gouging, especially when it comes to everyday goods like groceries. There are reports that she's going to be talking a bit about housing. I was able to speak briefly with Anderson Clayton, the North Carolina Democratic Party chairwoman in Asheville, while covering the Trump event earlier this week. And she said that the two things that she really expected to hear about were minimum wage and affordable housing.
And there are people who are saying, economists who are saying, that controlling price gouging, she wants to talk about having companies be prohibited from price gouging. I don't know how you define that, or whether you can say for definitely that a price is too high because the company is profiteering, but that's what she's suggesting. Do we know how economists feel about that?
I just read there was a piece in the Washington Post where mm-hmm. it was a conservative economist who kind of likened it. I mean, this is what Nixon had tried to do in the early 70s, dealing with inflation, and they made the comment that it didn't work then. That's going to be a really interesting thing to watch, because I have not seen in my lifetime talk about price controls and gouging. I mean, this is just very new territory.
Right. And I read something in which an economist said, the question is this messaging a reality? As messaging, it's probably effective because people want to see their grocery prices lower. As reality, as Steve pointed out, there's a whole lot of complications. And as you pointed out, I mean, does Trader Joe or Whole Foods get counted as a price gouger because they sell in a different environment? It's hard to imagine how this would play out as a real policy.
Also, if you believe economists, inflation is over. The inflation rate has come down to where it was prior to the pandemic. The problem is prices never come down. So I think this is probably the new reality of what we're paying at the grocery store and other places. Ever since she entered the race, Kamala Harris has been gaining on Donald Trump in the national polls. In North Carolina, she has begun to close the gap that existed between Trump and President Biden. And now, if you believe the polls, and they are a snapshot, and some people say they're not accurate, but it's a virtual tie. But High Point University survey research director Martin Kiefer says he does not expect to see major shifts in the presidential race here because we are so closely divided.
A lot of people have made up their mind who they'll vote for if they vote. And so, you know, things may have shifted a little bit back toward Vice President Harris. We've got one recent poll that has a tie, but most of the others, even those that were taken at about the same time, they're showing a narrow gap for Donald Trump.
But if you just look at how the candidates are treating this state by scheduling so many appearances here, you have to conclude that they see us as a state in play. Again, Martin Kiefer.
We are seen as a potential reach state for Democrats. That is, that if they're winning a lot of other places, you know, then they might be able to pick up North Carolina. Or Republicans at the presidential level, it tends to be one of those states they must win.
So, Mary, you wrote this week about how some Democrats see parallels in enthusiasm for Harris to that for Obama when he won North Carolina. So could she win this state, or are we going to be a loss at the presidential level for that candidate?
It remains to be seen whether she can turn this enthusiasm into an actual win. The thing about North Carolina is, you know, a Democrat has not won in the presidential election here since 2008. And when Barack Obama did that in 2008, he was the first Democrat to do it since Jimmy Carter. So we're not a battleground state, a swing state, in the sense that we go back and forth and who we're picking. But we are a battleground state in the sense that the margins are incredibly narrow. And so the idea amongst Democrats this election is that they can really lock in this burst of enthusiasm for Harris, and they can drive turnout, particularly amongst the demographics that helped Barack Obama win, African-American people, young people. They could potentially narrow the gap enough to get another narrow win for Democrats in November.
We have a lot of electoral votes in every presidential election. Does that make our state a must win for either or both of these candidates?
I think the math gets harder for Trump if he can't win North Carolina, and I think that's why you're going to see his campaign spending time and spending money here. It's not necessarily that they're, you know, that Kamala Harris is surging ahead of him in the polls, but she's getting closer, and that means having to put more time and money for the Trump campaign into defending the state, because if Kamala Harris is able to pull ahead in a state like North Carolina, where Republicans win the vast majority of the time in presidential elections, that could be a sign of concerns in other swing states too.
So she is here today, back to Trump's appearance earlier this week in Asheville. His speech there was promoted as being about the economy, but CNN reports that he struggled to stay on script. What a surprise. Instead, veering off into his usual litany of personal invectives against his foes, grievances for perceived slights, and of course, his usual litany of lies. And when he did wrap up his speech to a standing ovation and cheers, he referenced the word being used by Democrats when they talk about the Harris campaign. Joy, promising.
Everyone will prosper. Every family will thrive. And every day will be filled with opportunity, hope, and joy. But for that to happen, we must never let Kamala Harris get anywhere near the White House.
So, did he ever say how he would achieve those lofty goals, or simply that he, the man with all the answers, would make it happen?
Was more the latter. So he did make a pledge to decrease energy costs by at least 50% within his first 12 to 18 months in office, and did seem
How?
To indicate that would be done by increasing domestic oil production. And also,
we're already the largest producer of oil in the world right
yes.
now, have been for
yeah.
years.
Yes. Yeah. He claims that he will be able to make it even better by rolling back some Obama and Biden era environmental regulations. Remains to be seen whether that could actually be true. He spoke a lot about inflation, did not offer many specifics, referenced his plans to cut taxes on both tips and Social Security. Worth noting with that Social Security proposal that some economists have come out and said cutting taxes on Social Security payments could actually create some real long-term problems for the Social Security fund. So a few specifics sprinkled in, but mostly more sort of grand statements about how he will generate an economic boom. And if we elect Kamala Harris, things will be terrible and inflation will soar to double digits with little to back that up.
And he also says that the Biden-Harris administration has destroyed the American economy and it's better today than it was when he was president. The Harris campaign has been working to diminish Trump rather than make him the existential threat that people sometimes consider him to be. Her campaign communications director, Michael Tyler, wrote in a memo, quote, "No matter what he, Trump, says, one thing is certain. Trump has no plan, no vision, and no meaningful interest in helping build up the middle class. Is there anything in what Donald Trump has talked about during this campaign that would indicate that Michael Tyler is wrong?" I'll let it stay right there. Mary, you report that Donald Trump said he wasn't sure that the economy was the most important issue for voters. He said that inflation was top of mind. Well, of course, that's part of the economy. But the Labor Department reported this week that inflation reached its lowest level in more than 3 years in July. And economists are now saying that means inflation is over. The Fed is expected to reduce interest rates as a result of all this. But because inflation is over, it doesn't mean prices will come down. They're just not going up like they used to be. And that is going to be a hard sell, it seems to me, for Democrats, because I don't care that it stopped going up. It's still too expensive for a lot of folks. Can any president, I don't care who you are, what party you're from, impact the new normal of these higher prices? Really?
I don't know if they can, but I think both candidates are certainly going to try and sell voters on the fact that they could.
Meanwhile, we found out that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. a couple of weeks ago finally got his name on the North Carolina ballot in November. And this week, Cornel West also made inroads. He, too, will be on the ballot. This is a change. Steve, why?
So the North Carolina Democratic Party and other Democratic aligned groups had challenged, they challenged RFK's petition drive to get on the ballot unsuccessfully. They also challenged Cornel West, his efforts to get on the ballot. And the Democratic controlled State Board of Elections had voted to keep him off 3-2. Justice for All sued. A federal judge ordered this week that the state place them on the ballot. So now we will have 7 recognized political parties on the presidential ballot in North Carolina. I think that's the most. I was looking last night. It's the most in at least 50 years. So we're going to have a lot of choices when we go into the booth in November.
There were real fears by both Republicans and Democrats about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s candidacy because they thought he would siphon off just enough votes from one candidate or the other to swing the election in a direction that they weren't going to like. But his candidacy has turned out to be a kind of a three-ring circus. We have a story about his brain worm. Then we have the story recently about him dropping off a dead bear carcass in Central Park. And now the New York Times is reporting that he pitched the Harris campaign for a position in her cabinet in exchange for his support and was rejected. In a text message on Wednesday night, Kennedy wrote, quote, "We've reached out repeatedly through the highest level intermediaries. We've been told that they have no interest in talking with me." So does that make him a serious candidate at this point if he's looking to be in somebody else's cabinet?
I think you're seeing with RFK Jr., you know, if you go back to the spring, he would be polling in a lot of places at like 8%. And I think we're seeing those numbers go down, which is pretty common, you know, for third party candidates as we get closer to the election. Their support starts to dwindle.
So there's a lot of school news to report before we go back to school in a matter of moments, at least at CMS. Some schools are already in session, and we're going to go through all of that with WFAE's education reporter, Ann Doss Helms, when we come back from this break. We'll also get an update on what's going on at the Epicenter and the River District and more. It's the Local News Roundup. We're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter, Ann Doss Helms, WFAE's education reporter, Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for The Observer, and Alexandria Sands with Axios Charlotte. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. We're going to race through some education stories here. There's so much going on in advance of the start of school. This is the Local News Roundup on WFAE. CMS is preparing to go back to school in a matter of days. Ann Doss Helms is here. And we began hearing this week about what you characterized, Ann, as the topic that shall not be named. Student assignment. Why do you call it that?
They've been very careful to say it's the comprehensive review. And I think that's because student assignment is just such a third rail everywhere, not just in CMS. You know, when you start talking about changing boundaries, changing magnet programs, people get really stressed out about changes to their children's school. So, but that's what it is. We started with kind of a small slice this week, and they're saying they've been talking for 2 years about we're just about to do this comprehensive review of student assignment, and now they're saying September.
And this includes rethinking some magnet schools. Correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't we just do this like a year or two or three ago?
Literally, yes. I mean, some of these magnet changes, a lot of this was part of the 2023 bond. And I think it was in 2023 that they said, we're going to move around these arts magnets. We're going to move around these Montessori magnets. So that's just kind of a rolling thing. That's not a new big thing. But what they've had to do is basically put the finishing touches on it. The urgency even though it's not going to start until August of 2025, is that the choice lottery happens this fall. So, for instance, if you are in a homeschool zone that's going to a school that's about to become a full magnet, you're going to have a new homeschool zone. If you're at Marie G. Davis, which is becoming a total magnet school, you've got a new assignment. So it's that kind of thing.
So let's hopscotch through some of this. Charlotte Mecklenburg School Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill is proposing to add 9th and 10th grades to high schools located on CPCC's Cato, Harper, Levine, and Marancas campuses, adding a total of 800 new magnet high school seats, which would offer tuition-free college credit and a campus-based experience to those students.
It also will put money in their parents' pockets if they want to go on to a four-year university because they have completed 2 years of college before they enter a UNC Charlotte, for example.
Board member Monty Witherspoon asked what the impact of doing this would be on existing high schools and received this response from Deputy Superintendent Melissa Balknight.
So it would have an impact on enrollment at overall high schools, but they would be spread out throughout the county. And we have 28 traditional high schools.
And Hill is also looking at shuffling some arts programs, as you mentioned, relocating Montessori program. What else?
Those are the big things. And the other new thing that popped up was this plan to take the Dorothy J. Vaughan Technology Academy, which is an elementary school STEM magnet, and move it into the Parkside Elementary building, which is underfilled.
And Crystal Hill explained why.
So we are asking to move those students, not necessarily because of a program, but just because the building is old and it is very ineffective to run from a finance standpoint.
Any pushback to that suggestion?
I don't think so. I think there are questions about the name, because anytime you name something after someone, and Dorothy J. Vaughan, if you don't remember, is a Black female mathematician with NASA. She was one of the people featured in the Hidden Figures movie. So I think if they just say, now we have Parkside STEM, we've eliminated that name, there's going to be some blowback on that. So what they told us was the name is to be determined. They can go through the process, but that's not going to be part of this vote.
School Board Vice Chair D. Rankin notes that the upcoming phase of the student assignment review includes consultants' reports on magnets and demographics, and says just a look at data isn't enough, which elicited this exchange between the school board's D. Rankin and Deputy Superintendent Balknight.
When we get that information based on the demographics and based on the magnet program, do we plan on using that data to review our current student assignment boundaries?
That's a great question, yes, sir. And that's why I said the work in phase two will be intense and deep and will involve lots of community feedback and conversations at this level with the Board of Education, because we will use those national partners and the data that they are collecting to inform our decisions.
So phase two is part of this ongoing process, and it all starts, it's aimed at starting next school year. Is that correct?
No, the phase two, the reporting, the discussion is going to happen in September. Probably the changes would be even further out than 2025. But when you start talking about, they used to talk about the SPUD formula, stability, proximity, utilization, and diversity. You know, all of those things. Are we using the buildings right? Or how should we be handling diversity? Should we be doing more to keep kids close to home? And are we going to just shake up the apple basket and, you know, lose stability? Those are all really tough topics. And again, what D. Rankin is saying is we're not just going to get a study and, you know, check the box and throw it in a basket. We're going to really take a hard look at these things.
Meanwhile, CMS is struggling to cope with a dearth of students at its Pace Academy for teens who are newly arrived and learning to speak English. Talk about what Pace Academy is, first of all, and why, because there are a number of students who are here who don't speak English, and this would benefit them greatly, but they're not coming to that school. Why not?
Yeah, and this is a classic half empty or half full. You could say CMS really botched this, or you could say this challenge is really big. They're both true, I think. The Pace Academy is a chance for the newcomers who are teenagers, because again, it's a different thing to come and start learning English when you're 14 than when you're four. So sure. These teenagers who face a lot of challenges, what they were promised was a location at Waddell High School in Southwest Charlotte that would be part of a bigger magnet program. There would be lots of career tech opportunities there, and they'd be part of this full school. And then the career tech opportunities started dropping. And then it was just an aviation career magnet. And then they said, we can't pull that off either. So what they got was a location in basically an empty school. It's also the virtual school, but, you know, virtual students are not there. So they don't have English-speaking peers. They don't have all of the things that you associate with the full high school experience. And enrollment was down a lot last year. They worked hard during the school year to build it up, but it was still nowhere near what they were expecting. They, you know, they tried again for this year. And what I heard a lot with this proposal to move it to Geringer, which is right in the heart of Charlotte's international community, they'd have a lot of peers speaking English. They'd have a lot of good things. And what people were saying is, this is actually a pretty good proposal. Why on earth would you bring it to us less, you know, 2 weeks before the students go back and teachers are, you know, going back today in a lot of cases. So they shot it down. They said, you know, this needs to be part of that comprehensive study to figure out what the heck we're going to do with Waddell, because that school has really struggled to find, CMS has struggled to find the right purpose for it.
Okay. You followed up this week on a WCNC-TV report that indicated CMS had missed out on 2 years of grants to help homeless students because of a paperwork error. What did you find?
Not a lot. You know, they sent out this little statement, and I felt like we kind of saw the best and worst of CMS communications this week. They were trying really, really hard, I think, to do the student assignment stuff clearly and communicate it to reporters. But on that paperwork error, we got this little one paragraph statement. They did not respond to my follow-up questions. They did not make anybody available for interviews. So they're just saying, we knew about this a year ago, more than a year ago. We've found the funds. We're not, you know, not losing out on the services for these kids. And they would not tell me the amount of money involved, but they said it represented 0.0038% of our total budget, which, I'm sorry, that just smacks of being cute. You know, why not say the amount? Because I did the math. It's about, if all those decimals are right, and I think that's a big if, it's about $77,000 per year. That's not a big amount. But again, I'm just not confident at this point that they have been candid about that.
So when they say we knew about this, are they talking about staff or did the school board know about it?
I have been told by two school board members that during that four-hour meeting, phones started pinging and it was the WCNC alert about this story. And that was the first that many, if not all of the school board members knew about it. And that's a big drop of the ball.
You also reported this week on a principal swap at West Charlotte High School. Principal Dwight Thompson will be leaving just before students returned, and that is tinged with irony because Catherine Truitt, the outgoing state superintendent of education, was talking to you about how to improve public education, in which she pointed to the necessity of having good leadership and stability at the top in our schools. And she quickly sang the praises of, quote, one of the best and brightest principals she's come across during her tenure.
That's the Southwest Regional Principal of the Year for Charlotte and Dwight Thompson. I mean, this is someone who came to Renaissance West STEM Academy in 2021. It's one of the highest poverty schools in Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District. In the short amount of time that he's been there, they have exceeded growth every year when historically this was an F school that never even met growth, let alone exceeded growth.
So, of course, Thompson is leaving the district in mid-September. Do we know why?
We do not. I mean, I think it's safe to assume he hasn't been fired. He's very highly regarded statewide and locally. And that is a perpetual challenge, is you have a few people who can make gains. And to be clear, Renaissance West is not the miracle. You know, it's not, everybody's not succeeding, but they've made real strides. He's widely reviewed as having brought in a strong faculty, as having, you know, improved the culture, the discipline, the suspensions. And those folks tend to, you know, he's got a national profile because Renaissance West is part of this national purpose-built communities thing. So he has been responding to my texts with little, you know, thumbs up emojis and things, which is his way of saying, hey there, you know, I'm not going to talk to you right now. So I'm guessing he's been poached by possibly a national or state education reform agency, but it could be another school district.
Okay, before we move on, a bit of news about the woman who beat Catherine Truitt, from whom we just heard in the Republican primary, and who was running against Democrat Mo Green to be the state superintendent of schools. That's Michelle Morrow. We had Mo Green on this program for an hour and offered equal time to Morrow. She accepted, and then the night before the program, she pulled out, promising to reschedule, and now she won't return our calls. The invitation is still open, by the way. And she has said some controversial things over the years. She has accused the public schools of using their position as a platform to push a, quote, godless agenda, to push the idea that capitalism is evil, as is the free market, and that the United States has wreaked havoc across the world and needs to pay the price for it. None of those assertions are true. She's running as a Republican, and has had this to say about Democrats.
The Democratic platform is of the devil. Every part of it is of the devil, and we have got to fight against that.
Michelle Morrow also made comments on her social media platforms and elsewhere, calling for the execution of Presidents Joe Biden and other prominent Democrats like Roy Cooper and Barack Obama. In the aftermath of January 6th, she called for Trump to activate the military and put the Constitution to the side to stay in power, and suggested that all members of Congress could be arrested for treason. Well, she spoke this past Tuesday with WRAL-TV, and she tried to walk back some of those statements.
My words were not to arrest people for treason.
Okay.
I was stating that when our government is not protecting the God-given inalienable rights of our citizens, that it is our duty to make sure that they understand that they work for us.
And she is why this race is getting national attention. Enough said. The other race getting national attention is the governor's race because of Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who has made some, he's been involved in some iffy things, according to the state government. Mary, you reported this week that he is now responding to the charges by blaming who?
Yes. So speaking during former President Trump's rally in Asheville this week, Lieutenant Governor Robinson referred to the weaponization of government against its citizens and specifically cited the example of his wife's balanced nutrition program. He said it was a well-run business until folks found out that he was involved, that it was connected to him. And then he was unfairly investigated by the state and went on to allege that that was connected to Attorney General Josh Stein, his Democratic opponent. Its wife, Anna Stein. The Observer confirmed that Anna Stein has worked with the Department of Health and Human Services, which investigated balanced nutrition, but she was not involved in any way in that investigation, according to the department. She was a legal consultant for public health, specifically working on anti-smoking campaigns and also some health guidelines for prisons. And the Stein campaign has denounced Lieutenant Governor Robinson's comments.
Okay. After several years of troubles centering on crime in and around Epicenter, and after the pandemic led to the shutdown of that once thriving entertainment, eating, drinking complex at Trayton College, it closed a while back. It got new owners, a new name, Queen City Quarter. Aside from that, Alex, what's happened there?
Yeah, Queen City Quarter, we had some new businesses opening there. Three new restaurants this summer. It seems like most of the leasing momentum is happening on the outside of the building, like facing the streets. I walked through the inside. It still felt a little dreary and abandoned inside there, but it's picking up a little bit.
And they want to make this into a family-friendly destination. Given its location, its history, the construction, the way the place looks and operates, is that even possible?
I mean, perhaps. I think that I spoke to a bartender there who said that it might be best if Epicenter or Queen City Quarter just went back to kind of being a bar-centric destination because they would bounce off each other that way. But it certainly doesn't feel super family-friendly just yet.
Meanwhile, Charlotte's River District is starting to become a reality. You reported, Alex, this week that Charlotte's largest swath of undeveloped land, that is the River District, may have its first homes and residents by as early as next summer. Do tell.
Yeah, Crescent Communities had just announced that they brought on 4 home builders. So it's just a little bit of a milestone there that they're going to start building. And then those will start popping up by next summer and start filling up, which it's really interesting to see people finally living there. 1,400 acres of land that they're going to build out into this community at the biggest master plan development since Ballantyne. So
And some big name builders involved here: David Weekley Homes, DRB Homes, Toll Brothers, and Saucy Burbank. Why does this project seem to be on the fast track when Brooklyn Village and Eastland Yards have taken decades to do anything with?
And that's been top of mind, especially talking about Brooklyn Village.
And I should mention before we leave that COVID levels, if you look at wastewater examinations, COVID levels are on the rise. So the new shots, the new booster shots for the new variants coming out in the fall, the new shots last about 3 months to stop the disease and 6 months to prevent serious illness. But you want to think about getting it, I suppose. And we'll end with that. Steve Harrison here from WFAE News, and Doss Helms also with WFAE, Mary Ramsey with the Charlotte Observer, and Alexandria Sands with Axios Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour. Have a great weekend.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.